Chapter 5. Collective and Communal Violence. In contrast to interpersonal or intimate violence, which often involves violent encounters between individuals or small groups of people, collective violence can involve crowds of people, sometimes referred to pejoratively as the mob, as well as groups that are part of a specific organization, more or less organized depending on the circumstances. Different kinds of collective violence have existed throughout history, from subsistence riots and large-scale revolts to revolutions. Much of the collective unrest in Europe, China, and India over the centuries were subsistence-related. That is, there were long traditions of food riots and tax revolts brought about by the fear of starvation. Riots around food supplies or food shortages had largely ceased in Europe by the middle of the 19th century, as greater agricultural productivity, modern transportation, and an increasingly urbanized landscape finally solved the problems of supply that had once provoked local outbursts in the Western world. Instances of collective violence centered around food supply are now largely a thing of the past, even if there are sporadic eruptions, such as those that we saw in Africa and Bengal in 2007 and 8, when worldwide commodity prices rose sharply, and in Venezuela in 2016 and 17, when the disastrous economic situation resulted in thousands of protests. There are two distinctions to be made here. What may be called spontaneous collective action, occasions during which people react to what they see as an injustice, and prolonged, large-scale collective action, which requires an organization of some kind to take the lead. I'll look at a distinction between these two forms of violence in a moment, but collective violence can also range from the criminal to the political, from gangs and organized crime to riots, to strikes and social movements that might turn violent if they see no other way to achieve their goals. We have seen this in any number of movements in the first decades of the 21st century, including clashes between white extremists and Antifa, the anti-fascist movement, as well as the Black Lives Matter movement and the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong in 2019 and 20. It is not possible to cover adequately every kind of collective violence here or to make any overarching conclusions. I will, however, focus on four different types of collective violence and how they may have evolved over the centuries. The first two entail revolt and revolution. What motivates people to riot and revolt other than food? What drives them on occasion to commit acts of atrocity against figures of authority and behave in a crowd in ways they would never consider doing as individuals, and what drives communities to overthrow governments. The third consists of religions and ethnic or race riots. The two were often but not always intertwined, which continued in Europe well into the 20th century, and which continue to take place in other parts of the world today. Two case studies will help illustrate this: the pogrom in Eastern Europe and lynching in United States. The fourth form of collective violence is the criminal. I'll look at gang-related violence in the Americas. Let me begin, however, by looking at the vexed question of a crowd mentality. The crowd mentality. Is there such a thing as crowd mentality that allows people to commit acts of violence in group settings they would never consider doing as individuals? The classic text on the crowd is a book by Gustave Le Bon, written in 1895, called The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. It was translated into 16 languages and became one of the most influential psychology texts of all time. It not only theorized but created the idea of mass politics in the 20th century and was cited by Mussolini and Goebbels. Le Bon argues that when people get together in a crowd, they lose their individuality. Because individuality is the basis of judgment and reason, people become subject to contagion in the crowd. Unable to resist any passing idea or emotion, people subsequently regress to something more primitive, something more brutal. The crowd then is irrational, and it can be violent. Le Bon writes, by the mere fact that he forms a part of an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultivated individual. In a crowd, he is a barbarian, that is, a creature acting by instinct. An individual in a crowd is a grain of sand amid other grains of sand, which the wind stirs up at will. This view is, however, political and is therefore a defense of the status quo. It is aimed at proving the common people should be feared as a potential threat to civilization. Most crowds are not violent. Consider concerts, most sporting events, and most demonstrations. Many sociologists, psychologists, and social scientists today do not accept the idea of a crowd mentality. Stephen Ryker, who challenges the pathologizing of crowds, argues that people do not surrender their identity or lose themselves in a group. Instead, individuals who join the group embrace a collective identity, one usually framed by rules. This is certainly the case for football hooligans in Europe, who are often highly organized and follow ritualistic patterns of violence. Crowds are not entities that exist outside of specific social context. They are responses to specific events and shaped and limited by the concerns of those who form the crowd. Three other, more recent sociological theories address crowd behavior. The first is convergence theory, whose proponents argue that the behavior of a crowd is the result of like-minded individuals with pre-existing values and beliefs coming together. If the crowd becomes violent, it is because the people who came together in the crowd wanted it to be violent. Then there is emergent norm theory, whose proponents argue that behaviors are only determined after like-minded individuals come together, and that they are largely rational. One of the more influential theories, value-added theory, also called structural strain theory, argues that social movements and other collective behaviors only occur if four preconditions are met. Structural strain, when people are angry and frustrated by social problems, generalized beliefs, which include both people's understanding of societal problems and their solutions for resolving them, precipitating factors, events that suddenly spark a riot, movement, demonstration, and lack of social control when participants do not expect to be arrested or otherwise punished. All these conditions must exist for any kind of collective behavior to occur. The storming of the Capitol building in Washington by an angry mob in January 2021 appears to be an example. The crowd and the culture of retribution. As with food riots, collective political disturbances appear to have become less frequent in Europe over time. Summarizing the long-term trends, the American sociologist Charles Tilly stated that, on the whole, the repertoires of contention that began to prevail in Western Europe and North America during the 19th century had lower probabilities of producing violence than their predecessors. Not only shaming ceremonies, but also invasions of posted fields, seizures of grain, explosions of unwelcome representatives of authority, machine breaking, destruction of dishonored houses, and a number of other forms of direct action were well-known violence-producing routines in the 18th century that almost disappeared during the 19th. Tilly found, for example, that in the 18th and the early 19th century England, the number of meetings, riots, demonstrations, and assemblies had not necessarily declined. but the percentage of gatherings at which people were killed or injured dropped sharply. In other words, political contestation was becoming less violent. There were exceptions to the rule, such as the Portaloo Massacre of 16th of August 1819, when militia attacked protesters in Manchester demanding parliamentary reform. The attack led to 18 killed and hundreds injured. Before that, the Gordon Riot of 1780, brought about by an attempt to reduce discrimination against Catholics, was the most violent and prolonged unrest in 18th century England, with 285 dead and 200 wounded. Throughout most of European history, riots and revolts, urban and rural, rejected change, whether it was economic, political or religious, and they occurred frequently. According to one study conducted by a group of French researchers led by Jean Nicolas, more than 8,500 incidents in which four or more people were involved took place in France alone between 1661 and 1789. The French historian, Orlean Linguero, has inventoried a total of 460 revolts between 1800 and 1813 in the territories annexed to the French Empire. Another 71 revolts can be added for the year 1814, and that is not counting the 1,000 or so revolts that took place inside France. Historians tend to focus on violent unrest, but that can skew our perspective. As a recent work has shown, for the French Revolution, the majority of protests in the streets of Paris between 1787 and 1795 were non-violent. It would be interesting to see whether this was the case for urban environments elsewhere in Europe and beyond, or the extent to which French popular politics may have influenced protests in other parts of the world. Violence, then, was not the first response, but was often a culmination of an array of responses to what was perceived as an injustice. A new tax or an increase in taxation, the price of grain and of bread, the mandatory billeting of soldiers, a change in systems of agriculture, or by a new incursion of the state of local authority. There was no such thing as a typical riot, and most had several causes. In England, the biggest cause of popular protest in the 16th and 17th centuries was the enclosure of common lands. Protests were characterised for the most part by an attack on authority figures for what were perceived to be abuses of power. This is what the historian William Beake calls an expression of the culture of retribution. That is, there was an element of vengeance in the crowd behaviour bent on pushing people who should have known better. According to some scholars, the nature of collective violence in Europe changed over time. If Charles Tilly believed that they were becoming less lethal, William Beake's views are more ambivalent. He argues that the violence carried out by the crowds had its roots in traditional revolts and riots that had been practiced for centuries. The crowds had always attacked people in authority if they thought they were abusing their power. However, the traditional patterns of violence, retributive violence, changed over time, and the French Revolution seems to mark a turning point. During the Revolution and the Depository, for the first time, we began to see decapitated heads being paraded around on pikes as trophies. Of course, the decapitated heads and the remains of convicts had often been displayed on castle walls and ravenstones, a raised platform in which the corpse of the executed was left. The name is a reference to the birds that came to feast on the rotting body. In the medieval and early modern period, while body parts had been displayed and even sold during the French Wars of Religion as a means of humiliating the victim, but the violence of the revolutionary crowd, according to Beake, was the result of a new kind of emotion, joy mixed with fear. The revolution saw the invention of a new ritual language that quickly spread and died out almost as quickly within a few years. Let's look at one example. In September 1792, news reached Paris that a Parisian army had invaded France and was advancing towards the capital. At the same time, rumours circulated that Parisians, who secretly opposed the revolution, would help prepare for their arrival. Radicals known as Jacobins broke into the prisons, where they began to kill the prisoners, priests, nobles, women, common law prisoners, because they were feared to be counter-revolutionaries. Between 1,100 and 1,400 prisoners were killed in a matter of days. There is here a fundamental shift in the collective violence, from wanting to punish and humiliate those held responsible for injustices and wrongs, to wanting to physically eliminate those seen to be political enemies. But a further change took place during the revolution, so that the state, once again, assumed control of violence. Popular violence gave way to revolutionary state violence. I'll come back to state violence in the next chapter, but during the Terror of 1793-74, there is both the execution of around 40,000 people across all classes, nobles, clergy, peasants, workers, considered counter-revolutionaries, as well as a horror of civil war in the region known as the Vendée in the west of France that may have claimed up to 250,000 insurgent and 200,000 Republican lives. Revolutions. Revolutions have occurred wherever there have been highly complex, stratified societies, although they are generally rare events. The word itself was first used in the 16th century in Renaissance Italy, revolutio, to describe the frequent changes in power taking place. It was only in the modern era that it came to mean a fundamental break with the past, usually through the violent overthrow of an existing regime. The major revolutions of the modern era were extraordinary complex events and have been the object of intense study, heated debate, and much theorizing. So it is impossible here to sum up the reasons why each of the revolutions descended into greater or lesser degrees of violence. What distinguishes a simple revolt or a large riot from a revolution? The answer is an idea coupled with a desire for radical social and political change. At the same time, a revolution is guided but not necessarily brought about by an organizing principle, an ideology whose goal is the complete renewal of society. That ideology can be promoted by an organization that has adopted it as its guiding principle. That was the case, for example, for the Bolsheviks in Russia. In many of the major revolutions that have occurred since the end of the 18th century, once a revolution begins, violence often becomes an integral part of the process, including political and social purges, as the revolution swings from moderate to radical, and as the society and the polity are completely transformed. This often results in civil war, as well as war with other states, sometimes because revolutionaries embark on a crusade to bring their ideology to others, but also because other groups or states intervene to restore the old order. In the case of anti-colonial revolutions, what are also dubbed wars of decolonization, they too can spread to neighboring countries. This happened with the American, French, Haitian, Mexican, Russian, and Chinese revolutions, but also with Latin America and Vietnam. Revolutionaries tend to be zealots who see the world in unequivocal terms. That is, one is either for or against their ideology and cause. The consequence of this is that anyone who opposes the prevailing ideology is considered an obstacle to the fulfillment of the revolutionary goals. They become enemies and are destined to be persecuted and often eliminated. that is often done with brutal and ruthless efficiency. As a result, revolutionary leaders will appear only to be destroyed later by their own, as the process becomes more radical and more authoritarian. This happened to Danton and Robespierre during the French Revolution, and to people like Trotsky, Zinoviev, and Bukharin during the Russian Revolution. It was, in fact, a pattern that has repeated itself in just about every modern revolution, from North Korea and Vietnam to Iran. This dynamic has led at least one revolutionary group to see the external world as morally corrupt, as was the case with Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. Pol Pot attempted to wipe the slate clean, sweeping aside all existing political and social structures, and to start again, with the devastating consequences known as the killing fields, in which more than 1 million people were killed by the Khmer Rouge regime from 1975 to 1979. Why revolutions occur are as varied as the revolutions themselves, although it is possible to identify common patterns. There are always a number of structural factors that can come into play, including the dissatisfaction of elites with the regime, and serious economic and fiscal crisis that brings states to the brink of bankruptcy, often on the back of rising costs of living and food shortages. Fiscal and economic crises can be exacerbated by major natural disasters, as happened with the French Revolution, or they can come on the heels of serious military setbacks, as happened with the Russian Revolution. All these things can undermine the authority and legitimacy of the state or the head of state, but they must also occur at a time when there is a general and mounting popular dissatisfaction, and when the coercive institutions of the state, such as the army or the police, begin to waver and side with the protesters. Once rulers have completely lost touch with the bulk of the population and continue to pursue policies that alienate elites and the people from the state even further, the regime comes to be seen as illegitimate and unjust. This happened in Ceausescu's Romania in 1989. Despite these characteristics, not all revolutions are violent, and not all revolutions enter what might be called a radical phase. This is what happened with the so-called Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia in 1989, as well as in the Colour Revolutions of the early 2000s. In these instances, there was no elite dissatisfaction. The state was in control of its coercive forces, and the governments relatively stable. These were movements that overthrew corrupt regimes but were often in turn replaced by corrupt regimes with authoritarian tendencies. This occurred in Ukraine and during the Arab Spring and in Eastern Europe today. What of all the legacies of revolutions? The results are mixed, to say the least. The American Revolution was meant to institute a democratic regime, and it did up to a point, but it also created a polity based on slavery that led to political succession and civil war in 1860. The French Revolution resulted in a bitter civil war and 1 million dead and 22 years of warfare that resulted in millions dying across Europe. The Russian Revolution also resulted in millions of deaths in civil war, and eventually in a regime under Stalin whose collectivization, mass deportations and political repression caused millions more deaths. Similarly, the Chinese Civil War and the Cultural Revolution that followed occasioned several million deaths. Revolutions, in short, do not often lead to increased freedoms and human rights. In fact, several 20th century revolutions have led to curtailed freedoms and the introduction of authoritarian regimes that are often far worse than those that had preceded them. Race and religion in collective violence. other types of collective violence are intertwined with ethnicity and religion. This is the case, for example, for riots between Muslims and Hindus, and between Hindus and Sikhs in India, as well as the Buddhist attacks on Muslims in Myanmar. Let's focus on pogroms against Jews in Europe, which occurred for 9 centuries right up until the end of the Second World War. The word pogrom can be traced to the Russian for thunder or storm, but it was first used to refer to outbreaks of anti-Jewish violence by non-Jewish street mobs in the Russian Empire from 1881 to 1884. It has since become a byword for rioting regardless of time or place. Most of the original pogroms took place in an area that became known as the Pale of Settlement, a territory acquired by the Russian Empire between 1791 and 1835, which included present-day Belarus, Lithuania and Moldova, much of Ukraine and Poland, and some parts of Latvia and Russia. The Russian government forbade its Jewish subjects from settling in Russian territory outside the Pale of Settlement. Although an 1822 attack in Odessa is sometimes considered to be the first pogrom in the Russian Empire, most historians cite the 1881 incidents beginning in Elisavograd in present-day Ukraine as the beginning of the Russian pogrom phenomenon. The Elisavograd violence spread rapidly throughout 7 provinces in southern Russia and Ukraine, where peasant attackers looted Jewish stores and homes and destroyed property. Many individuals were beaten and/or murdered, and women raped in these pogroms. In 1881, pogroms also occurred in Kiev and Odessa, among 100 other locations. The main inspiration for these vicious attacks was the ideology of anti-Semitism. Jews were blamed for everything from weakened economic conditions to political instability. In addition, there was the claim that Jews murdered Jesus, and the myth of blood libel that charged Jews with murdering Christian babies and baking their blood into matzah, a Jewish flatbread used in Passover. Pogroms continued to occur into the early 20th century, sometimes fomented by Russian officials. Particularly violent were the pogroms from 1903 to 1906. The horrific 1903 pogrom in Chisinau, in what is now Moldova, killed dozens of Jews and resulted in the destruction of hundreds of homes and businesses, prompting tens of thousands of Russian Jews to flee. Estimates of the number of Jews killed during the Russian Civil War range from between 50,000 to 200,000, with many thousands of Jewish girls and women raped. This phenomenon was present in Central Europe during the interwar period and carried over into street violence against Jews in Nazi Germany. On the 9th and 10th of November 1938, a wave of violence known as Kristallnacht, Night of Broken Glass, was instigated by the Nazi Party. Street violence against Jews continued throughout the Second World War. In many areas under German occupation, Nazi officials and soldiers supported and encouraged pogroms. After the war, pogroms continued in Europe. A pogrom occurred in 1946 in Kielce, Poland, against Jewish Holocaust survivors who returned to the town, leaving 42 dead. These pogroms further motivated the already devastated Jewish population to seek refuge outside Europe. In America, collective violence was a common feature of life well into the 19th century. Riots could be triggered by any number of reasons, but they usually had to do with race, ethnicity, employment, and political affiliations. The city of New York, for example, with a population of fewer than 200,000, experienced more than 70 ethnic, labor, and political riots between 1788 and 1834. Some, such as the New York Riot of 1863, involved hundreds of people and lasted days, ending with around 120 people killed and 2,000 wounded. One of the largest race riots in the United States occurred in 1921, when the prosperous all-black community of Greenwood in Tulsa was destroyed after a black shoeshine boy was charged with assaulting a white elevator girl. No one knows how many people were killed, hundreds probably, but at least 800 were injured. Both of those riots were racial massacres instigated by whites against black communities. But black Americans also rioted, as we saw during the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the Los Angeles riot of 1992 in what the historian Elizabeth Hinton has called violent rebellion. Vigilantism blossomed in frontier regions, especially the West, and continued in the South for a century after the Civil War had come to an end. In some regions of the United States, authorities sometimes sanctioned and even participated in and invariably turned a blind eye to the violence that served to maintain the institution of white supremacy. Between 1882 and 1968, 4,733 people were lynched in the United States. Most, but not all of them, black. About a third were considered white, that is, Italians, Mexicans, and others who were accused in the language of the time of being nigger lovers. It is difficult, of course, to make generalizations, but when dealing with mass killings and lynchings by mobs, the victim is often killed twice, so to speak. After the lynching, the body is mutilated, beaten with whatever is to hand, burned, and dismembered. All these atrocities are about humiliating the victim further, and in the process making them unrecognizable, less than human, but it is also about sending a message to the living. Gang violence in the Americas. A more recent contributing factor to collective violence is organized crime perpetrated by gangs. In Central America, they are known as maras. In the slums of Nairobi, they are known as the Malgiki. In Los Angeles, the 18th Street Gang controls part of their neighborhood. In Salvador, it's the MS-13. There are many different types of gangs, from low-level street gangs to large groups that carry out turf wars and are involved in transnational criminal enterprises. People are murdered for any number of gang-related infringements, refusing to join the gang, joining the wrong gang, or refusing to cooperate with a gang when asked to do something, including sometimes handing over property, for example, a house or a farm. They share some traits with perpetrators of massacres, mass killings, and genocide in that the individual members bow to peer group pressure to kill. Gangs adopt honor codes that are like the codes once practiced by men in other cultures, in other times, such as in Italy during the Renaissance or in Greece during the 19th century. According to Mexican sociologist Ryle Rodriguez Gullion, there were more public lynchings in Mexico in 2015, at least 78, than at any other time in the last quarter century. That was more than double the number in 2014. There were another 60 lynching incidents in Mexico in 2017 and 174 in 2018, 58 of which resulted in deaths. Not all the lynchings are carried out by drug cartels. Sometimes they are the result of mob justice, people who turn on suspected criminals. There are several ways of interpreting lynchings in Central America, including broader explanations around culture and the absence of a strong civil society. But let me outline two. The first is to see it as the result of mob actions born of a sense of hopelessness and importance shared by many. In Mexico, for example, 98% of murders go unsolved, and the state is virtually absent in some areas. By some estimates, just 12% of crimes are even reported in Mexico, largely because of a lack of faith that justice will ever be served. The other way to see it is its exact opposite. Rather than signalling the absence of the state, lynching is an expression of a community's reaction towards a state presence that is perceived as intrusive and illegitimate. Lynchings, according to this theory, imitate the brutality of extra-legal forms of violence perpetrated by public officials at the local level. The reality is quite likely a combination of these two approaches. The two questions that have often plagued scholars of collective violence are what causes variations in the level and form of violence over time, and how and why do participants fluctuate between peaceful and violent social interactions. As we have seen, the answer to those questions invariably change with the form of collective violence being examined. Certainly, there has been a diminution of subsistence-related unrest around the world, one possible benefit of the modernization of food production. On the other hand, social movements that begin as peaceful social protests can turn violent, but they are overall less violent than in previous centuries. There are exceptions to the rule. At the time of writing, there were more than 700 civilians killed and many hundreds more injured in protests in Myanmar since the coup of the 1st of February 2021. I would suggest, from this brief outline, that different forms of collective violence are often interconnected, although we are yet to adequately understand those relationships.